Hello, and welcome to New Books in Public Policy. My name is Teddy Troy. I'm your host. Each week, we take a different book that has some relation to public policy, and we talk to the author about it. We get an expansive view of his thoughts on the book. And this week, the book is Pacific Cosmopolitans, A Cultural History of U.S.-Japan Relations. It's by Michael Ostlin. He's a scholar at the American Enterprise Institute here in Washington. He's also a columnist for WallStreetJournal.com, WSJ.com, and he's an expert on Japan and Asia and the U.S. relations with both the country and the area. So in a moment, we're going to get Misha Ostlin on the line and have him discuss his book and how cultural history between Japan and the U.S. has changed over the last few centuries, and it seems like there's a lot more history that's happened in the last couple of hundred years than you would expect in such a relatively short period in historical terms. So let's get Misha on the line, and we'll have a good talk with him. Hello, we have Misha Ostlin on the line. Misha Ostlin is the author of Pacific Cosmopolitans, A Cultural History of U.S.-Japan Relations. He's a scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, although I'll let him talk about his background. Misha Ostlin, welcome to New Books in Public Policy.
Thanks, Savvy. I appreciate you having me on today.
Can you tell us a little bit about yourself, background, who are you, how did you get to AEI, and how did you come to write this book?
Well, I've been at AEI for about 4 years. I direct the Japan Studies program there and also help run the Asian Studies program. Currently, I talk mostly about public policy, defense issues, security issues between not only the U.S. and Japan, but all of Asia, and have been focusing on the larger Indo-Pacific region. But before that, before I came down to AEI and D.C., I was a professor of Japanese history at Yale, and I was there for 7 years and wrote a couple of books while there, and the one that we're talking about today, Pacific Cosmopolitans, I actually wrote the bulk of it while at Yale and then finished it up down here in D.C. and just published it. So I started off, as I mentioned, as a Japanese historian. I taught everything from ancient Japanese history up to the modern period. Did my Ph.D. In 19th century Japanese diplomatic history and published a book out of the dissertation. And then slowly began to focus a little bit more on what Japan was doing currently and the U.S. policy both towards Japan as well as other Asian countries, and ultimately decided to try to come down to D.C. and had a great opportunity to come to AEI and talk about all the things that I think are important.
What was the book you wrote out of your dissertation?
That book is called Negotiating with Imperialism, and it was a it came out in 2004, also Harvard University Press, and it was a revisionist look at the first years of Japan's treaty relations with the West. You know, the typical story we had was that Commodore Perry sailed in with his black ships in the early 1850s and opened Japan, and then we forced these trade treaties on them. And somehow that caused Japan to modernize itself and emerge about 40 years later as this new powerful state that attacked China and attacked Russia, and before you know it, we're at Pearl Harbor. I mean, that was the traditional story that people had for decades. So instead, I looked at how relations actually worked and found that there was a lot more fluidity, there was a lot more give and take. The Japanese were far more active in actually shaping how their relations with the West developed, as opposed to just being forced into a corner, so to speak. And that sort of influenced where I went with this book, which was to try to look at a part of the relationship, which was everyone knows is important, but no one had really studied, which is what role exactly did the different types of cultural ties that Japan and the United States developed, what role did those play in the broader relationship that we usually think of as political and economic and of course, security-oriented?
Yeah, it's interesting. In your book, you talk about this notion of enduring cultural exchange. And I think Americans are aware that American culture, pop culture, is big in Japan. But I don't know that Americans have a sense of this notion of enduring cultural exchange. Can you talk about that and also generally what the book is about?
Well, the book is it's a narrative history. I mean, this is a huge story, and I note right up front that there's no book that can really talk about everything. They could talk about all the different ways in which Americans and Japanese encountered each other and then began to formalize the ways that, that they had exchange. And that's a process I can talk about a little bit later. But the enduring cultural exchange aspect of this relationship is one that I think historically you wouldn't necessarily expect. So, for example, we're familiar here with the ties we have with Britain, obviously, or France or Germany. And part of the reason we have those, of course, is because you have very large immigrant communities that settled in the United States that maintained either traditions from the homeland or some type of connection that lent itself ultimately to groups and organizations that promoted cultural ties between the two countries. In the case of Japan, we didn't have that. Not only did we not have a long standing sort of natural relationship with Japan, we had a very artificial relationship that was indeed started in some ways at the official level by Commodore Perry and those who followed him. But we also didn't have a very large and still don't really have a very large Japanese-American community. So you wouldn't necessarily think that just 40 or 50 years after Commodore Perry arrived in Japan, that you'd have Japan societies popping up all around the United States. You wouldn't necessarily think about how popular Japanese art became in the United States, or that there would be organizations devoted to helping train scholars and professionals on Japan. So to me, it seemed that it was not only a relatively certainly interesting and relatively unique historical story that I wanted to tell, but it also said something about the way in which our relationship with Japan has always been to some degree or another based on cultural ties. And then there's one other element of it that I mentioned I'm certainly happy to talk about more, but that is all of this is happening at a time when, first of all, both America and Japan are becoming world powers. So that, I think, is significant, and it may give us some hints as to how states that are becoming globally influential attempt both to order their foreign relations and try to shape them. So there's a tension between what the state does and then what private individuals do, of course, but also that this is happening almost precisely at the time that a global network of cultural exchange and intellectual exchange is developing, moving away from the old sort of British learned society model to the type of world where intellectuals or artists or performers or whoever could gather at international congresses, could cross the oceans, could publish their works and have them received in many different communities. And so the modern world that we don't really think too much about, where you have constant exchange between societies and cultures, is a framework in which the Japan-U.S. relationship developed and emerged, and I think very much influenced the subsequent history of that relationship.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Americans have this perception of Japan as a closed society culturally, and you talk in the book a little bit about restriction edicts. But you also mention a fact that I found fascinating, that by 1800, according to Donald Keene, the Japanese were the best informed people about what's going on in other cultures of anyone on the planet. And I think that is kind of contrary to people's perceptions.
Yeah, I would. I think it's an important point he makes. I mean, I might take it with a grain of salt as to whether it's absolutely true. But he was writing the book in which he wrote that was back in the 50s, and he was trying to show precisely how this point that you started off with, Japan as a closed society, really wasn't true. And there's been a lot of work since then that has attempted to show the ways in which Japan really was very much involved with the outside world, but on its own terms. So the old idea, again, we had of Commodore Perry coming in and opening up Japan really is an American conceit, and one that is probably natural but does not really reflect the reality of Japan's international experience. So what I actually start the book off with is not the beginning or the first, substantive chapter is not about Perry or the Japanese going to America or the like, but it's actually a brief history of Japan's encounter with the world, as well as America's encounter with Asia, because for Japan, in this period in which it was ostensibly closed, it actually had different types of relations with countries, primarily China, but those in Asia and Southeast Asia with which had trade and other relations. There was intellectual exchange. There was a lot of cultural exchange. A lot of what we think of today as Japanese came in during this period in the 1700s and 1600s when Japan was supposedly closed. Things like tofu and green tea and noodles and the like all were imported. Parts of, you know, daily material culture were imported in this period when Japan was supposedly isolated. So I look at all of that first, primarily to set up the argument that Japan had a deep and rich cultural engagement with the world when it then first encountered the United States. And from the American side, it's a little bit more interesting and complex because the Americans, of course, is a new country and a new nation located on the East Coast, primarily. We're nonetheless beginning to reach out, move from the West Coast into the Pacific, dotted communities of whalers and ultimately shippers and merchants, not only coming from New York, but from San Francisco and other communities. And they're encountering this massive world of Asia that they don't really differentiate much about. They don't always divide it up into its parts as they actually were. But in the American imagination, what was Asian and what did it represent? And so a lot of times you'll see, as I talk about in the books, American colonial newspapers talking about Japan as representative of a part of Asia that they simply didn't know much else about, but were labeling it as Japan. So there was a lot of ferment in both countries, a lot of cultural exchange, a lot of attempting to understand the world, map the world, order it in their own minds, and that is the framework in which suddenly they're thrown together, and from that, this rather vibrant cultural relationship then emerges.
That's actually a good lead into my next question, which is, who is Nakahama Manjiro, otherwise known as John Mung, and why is he important in your story?
Well, he was the first Japanese who really lived in the United States, as far as we know, and was a castaway, as many of the first Japanese to reach our shores were. A fisherman, a very young boy of around 15, when he was shipwrecked and then picked up by an American whaler. So we had a lot of American whalers out in the region. You'll remember Moby Dick talking about the whalers reaching out to Japan, the double bolted land, as Melville called it. And Manjiro was picked up, whereas his compatriots, in fact, were dropped off at other islands, possibly the Sandwich Islands, Hawaii, if I remember correctly, captured the ship in what today we would consider international kidnapping, probably, decided to take this young boy back to Fairhaven, Massachusetts, and had him live with his family, put him into school, educated him, taught him skills and crafts and the like. And after a period of several years, Manjiro ultimately decided to try to come back to Japan and spent another several years working his way back to Japan on various ships, by which time he had actually gained a whole bunch of skills that were taught to him in the United States. At this point in Japanese history, there was an edict against traveling abroad. So those Japanese who left the islands, either by their own volition or because they were shipwrecked and brought to other lands, returned only on pain of death because of the way that the shogunate, which controlled the country, attempted to control foreign relations. So Manjiro took his life in his hands coming back, but he comes back right at the end of the shogunal period, when Japan recognizes that something has to change in its relations with the world, as well as its domestic political structures. And instead of being summarily executed, he is in fact hired by the shogunate to teach them about America and the world. He becomes an intelligence resource for them, and writes in his, basically what is his debriefing, what he calls his diary, talks about the United States and talks about his experiences there, which are largely colorless. They're bloodless. They're not filled with anecdotes and stories, but they're much more prosaic descriptions. But it was the first firsthand account Japanese had really had of the United States, as opposed to secondhand accounts through the Dutch or fanciful accounts that they made up. So Manjiro is significant, and he's contemporaneous with a few other Japanese who also were shipwrecked and brought to the United States and witnessed, in essence, the birth of a new world in Japan, and in many ways were the harbingers of it.
You know, that raises actually an interesting point about this notion of intelligence or spying between the two nations, because obviously just by simple appearance, the people before there was a lot of exchange, popular exchange, people look very different. And so I know the Americans had a very tough time getting any information about what Tokyo looked like in the lead into World War II. And there's the famous story of Mo Berg, the baseball catcher, going on a baseball exchange and taking pictures from a building in Tokyo that gave the American planners the only views they had of Tokyo leading into World War II. What was your experience on intelligence exchanges between the two countries? And you sort of wonder if that might be a book in itself.
Well, of course, during this period, there wasn't anything such as formal intelligence. You know, we didn't have an intelligence agency until during World War II, and the Japanese had I think we could call a proto-intelligence agency, primarily directed towards mainland China, where they were having all sorts of different attempts to penetrate Chinese society or control the areas that they did have troops in during the 1920s and 30s, and they would use adventurers and use army soldiers and the like. So both of us were actually pretty slow on the uptake in terms of modern intelligence, although even the Europeans didn't really formally start their intelligence gathering activities until the 20th century.
So everyone had to rely on the spy master.
Well, she did. I think a lot of it is our way of sort of interpreting, you know, the gathering of information and the first attempt to actually systematically collect information and interpret it and use it. And so some did, like Walsingham, who worked for Queen Elizabeth. And then you had, in fact, in the case of Japan, starting around 1800, which is far before most other nations, was a group that was actually called the Astronomical Bureau, whose job was to collect information on foreign lands, to translate foreign books to the best of their ability, and to send that information directly to the government decision makers. So it's not sort of spies and James Bond as we think about, but much more the sort of scholarly, nerdy folks who are sitting there reading newspapers and reading books and trying to glean bits of information. The Japanese did this also by questioning those who came and visited their land. Some that they didn't allow in except when they would sometimes shipwreck themselves. And I actually talk about a case of an American who shipwrecks himself in Japan. They would lock up and then they'd interrogate. They would interrogate the crews of ships that were allowed to dock at Nagasaki. The Dutch were actually forced to supply the Japanese with basically intelligence reports every year about the state of the world, and those were sent up from Nagasaki up to the shogunal headquarters in Edo, which is today's Tokyo. So there is lots of different ways in which the Japanese gathered information. I think the Americans were much slower. Really were not as focused on it. We're focused much more on the commercial aspect of learning about Japan as well as the rest of the world. Whereas for the Japanese, they felt a sense of danger. And it was danger precisely because there were different cultures impinging on their way of life and forcing themselves on Japan. By the time Mo Berg goes over in the 30s, Japan is a very different world, of course, and a different country. And there's a lot of different ways to gather information about Japan from the newspapers, from things like National Geographic, which had wonderful photo spread. So he may have been sent to, you know, tasked to take specific types of pictures, maybe of port facilities or things like that. But certainly the world that rapidly developed in Japan from the first years of contact in the 1850s to, you know, about three quarters of a century later, the 1930s or so, is one in which we do get a lot of information, and we get it precisely because of this rapid increase in cultural and economic ties between the two countries.
Yeah, you mentioned China in there and Japan's interest in getting intelligence of China, but you also talk about Chinese culture and how important it was in Japan. Can you talk a little bit about the role, the sort of rivalry between Japan and China and how China was viewed by Japan?
Well, it's always been the great influence on Japan. China has been from, millennia ago. The Japanese looked to China for concepts of politics and kingship and state rule. They obviously adopted their ideographic script, kanji, from China. They adopted technology from China that was used for political purposes, adopted architecture and architectural forms. The earliest cities in Japan were actually patterned after Chinese imperial cities of, straight grid line avenues and streets and palaces and the like. So China has always been central to Japan's civilizational formation. This book actually is situated at the moment when Japan finally, in a way, and formally turns away from China and turns toward the West. I mean, there were moments earlier, particularly in the late 1500s and early 1600s, when Japan also was fairly engaged with the West. The period of William Adams, the English pilot who comes to Japan and is made a samurai. But this period, when Japan has fully identified itself as part of the Chinese world, or in some cases has actually sought, at least in its own mind, to supplant China as the center of Asia and the center of the universe, it now realizes that there's a different civilization that is superior, a different world that offers more riches, more strength, and decides to pursue that. And in many ways, it's America that represents that for the Japanese. I mean, they're obviously very interested in Britain. They're interested in Germany. They're less interested in Russia, a little bit interested in France. But it's really, in many cases, America that the Japanese turn to, and they identify with America. Whereas before, they had identified with China as the most advanced society and civilization on Earth. Now they identify with the Americans as a brash, new, young civilization that is increasingly powerful and increasingly influential, and one that they want to pattern themselves after. And so they send out students and they send out official embassies, and they basically supplant China with America and the rest of the West, but with America in this period in the late 1800s. Ironically, fairly soon after that, of course, as Japan becomes a colonial power after defeating China in 1895, taking over Formosa, which is today Taiwan, and then Korea, and the United States becomes a colonial power in 1898 after defeating Spain, taking over the Philippines and Hawaii, that the two, as convinced as they are of the importance of the other, also now begin to see geopolitical threat. And so the fascination and the cultural fascination doesn't change, it doesn't ebb, it continues, but it is overlaid in a way with the state concern about the threat posed by the other, by the navy of the other and the policies of the other. So there's a great tension that develops, the same type of tension Japan always had with China. This tension is now transferred to the United States and is one that ultimately winds up in the tragedy of war.
Yeah, I'd love to talk about this 20th century story, but before we do that, you've mentioned Commodore Perry a few times, and I'm just concerned that some of our listeners might not really know who Commodore Perry was and why he was important. Can you just give us a quick breakdown on Commodore Perry and how he kind of got the ball rolling?
Well, he was actually in many ways the culmination of American attempts to reach out to Japan, not because Washington, D.C. was interested in Japan, but because they were interested really in two things. One, having coaling stations for U.S. Navy ships that would be ultimately reaching China, And secondly, because of all the American whalers that were in the North Pacific, they needed an agreement with Japan that would allow these whalers to seek shelter there or to get supplies there. And so the Americans had made several attempts. Some initially were done by merchants privately, and then there was an attempt in the 1830s and the 1840s by the Americans to reach out to the Japanese. But the shogunate was at this time moving into its final reactive phase. And whereas Japan before had in many ways been open to the outside world, though on its own terms, in this period of the 1830s, 20s and 30s and 40s was actually closing up far more than it had before. The British were also beginning to knock on Japan's doors, moving through Southeast Asia and, of course, into China's mainland during the Opium Wars. So Japan knew the world was changing. So Perry is sent out on a second formal U.S. mission to try and open Japan in 1853, where he goes and delivers a letter from the president of the United States, Millard Fillmore, to the Japanese leaders, and then returns the following year in 1854 to negotiate a very limited trade treaty. But this is a moment of great national shock to the Japanese. Perry sails in with a steamboat, which they had never seen, a steamship, you know, enormous ships with cannons that had crossed the ocean. He diplomatically played his hand very well by refusing to be deterred by Japanese refusal to initially meet with him, and he refused their refusal. So the Japanese were forced to treat with him and to deal with him. And it ricocheted throughout Japan. There were penny broadsheets that talked about Perry and painted him as a devil, and that his black ships belched smoke and fire. There was a political panic. It led to economic panic. All of this ultimately leading to a significant weakening of the ruling shogunate, the ruling samurai family, who lost power 15 years later. And on the other end of the equation, Perry became a hero in the United States. I mean, people had known about Japan. We here considered it a closed land because we didn't have relations, and no one except the Dutch had relations with Japan. And it was an American who, quote-unquote, opened it up. So Perry published a very popular journal and a three-volume study of his mission to Japan was published, and he basically became a national hero in opening up Japan. And you know, if you ask Japanese today, the Americans that they really know best from history, it's Commodore Perry and General MacArthur, who was the basically the overlord of Japan during the occupation after World War II.
Now, was Commodore Perry today, you say he's well known in Japan, but is he seen as a positive character or still as that kind of devil with the black smoke coming out of him?
No, I think he's seen largely as positive. I mean, you hear very little negative about Perry, and I think it's because Japanese recognize that in some ways he did set in motion the train of events that led to a modern Japan. It wasn't obviously all his doing or his decisions that were made, but it was his refusal to take no for an answer that forced Japan into signing its first set of formal treaties. I mean, that's the topic of my first book and what that meant for Japan. So I think he's very well known. I mean, is he loved? I wouldn't necessarily say he's loved, and in many ways the Japanese revere MacArthur because they felt MacArthur could have been much harsher in dealing with Japan after World War II. Perry is seen as the moment of transition between two worlds, between the Japan of the samurai and a feudal system that would have kept itself largely apart from the world, though not entirely, and the Japan that emerged as a world power.
Yeah, you know, it's hard to love MacArthur for anyone who's really followed his mess ups in the Korean War, but I'm glad at least the Japanese like him. The talk of Perry and his kind of movement into the Japanese harbors with these large guns and the threat is a good lead in to the change or the shift in the U.S. Japan relationship that you started to talk about a couple of minutes ago in the 1920s and 30s as Japan becomes more of an obvious threat, especially after 1905 when they defeated the Russians. discussions, and there was sort of a sense of two heavyweights sizing each other up in this period. Can you talk a little bit about this period and how cultural exchange was dealt with in that time?
Well, it's a moment when, for Japan, the world is in essence opening up, and it's hard, I think, for us to imagine what it must have been like to go through an era where everything was upended. I mean, from politics to the economic structure of society, to the things that really matter to people, which is their daily lives, and it comes about precisely because of this connection between Japan and its trading partners. The treaty ports where foreigners could live, the restrictions on travel that were lifted, so Japanese could go abroad and the like. And there was a famous British scholar of Japan, actually, Basil Hall Chamberlain, who was very well known around the turn of the century, who wrote that for someone like him, who had come to Japan at the end of the feudal period and then witnessed the modernization, it was as though he had lived from the Middle Ages to today and seen compressed into one lifetime hundreds of years of change in the West. And for the Japanese, it was just as bewildering. I mean, you know, for people out in the countryside and the peasants, did their lives change that much? Not that much, slowly but surely. But for those in the cities and urban areas or quasi-urban areas, obviously those engaged in trade or travel, the world within the space of just a few decades was completely upended. And it led to everything. I mean, there were some who adopted it for pure economic purposes, people who opened up breweries or opened up steamship factories or textile mills, others who adopted things from the West and America, for example, that were more intellectual in nature, so political ideas, poetry, new ways of writing novels and art and the like. So it was a period of intense ferment and not without backlash. I mean, there were many Japanese who rejected this and who thought that Japan was losing its unique culture and its soul and would not be something it would not be the Japan of its forefathers, and therefore not really Japan. If it was attempting to ape the West and act like the West, then what was it to be Japanese? And in some ways, I think that's the great question of modern Japanese history, as Japan threw off 700 years of one type of rule and over the past 150 has attempted to create a new type of society. The question is, who are we as Japanese, and what does it mean to be Japanese? All of those questions, I think, really come to the fore in this period of the late 1800s and the ferment of cultural discovery.
Yeah, you know, when you look at this story that you're telling, it's just amazing how much happens in such a relatively short period. Because, I mean, right now we're talking about the lead-in into World War II, and obviously in World War II, the U.S. and Japan, even though they were building up relations, positive relations for a long time, I mean, dehumanized each other, demonized each other. I mean, we all know that the Japanese were put in internment camps here in the U.S., and the Japanese soldiers and U.S. soldiers just had the worst things to say about each other in the Pacific fight. But then I know President Bush, when I worked for him in the White House, he often used to talk about his good relations with Prime Minister Koizumi and how they were such good friends. And 60 years earlier, I guess Bush's father and Koizumi's grandfather had been opponents in that war, and how things can change so rapidly. So can you talk about that World War II period? And obviously, after the dropping of the atomic bomb, the Japanese were understandably not favorably disposed to the U.S. How bad was it in World War II, and how did it start to turn around?
Well, it's interesting, precisely because of the warmth of relations before the war, as I said, overlaid with that geopolitical suspicion. The fact that you had these societies that I talk a lot about in the book, places like the Japan Society or the America-Japan Society Network, both here and in Japan, growing types of student exchanges and individual exchanges. There was a group that still exists. Actually, all these groups still exist, and one called the Japan-America Student Conference. There were so many different ways for Japanese and Americans to begin encountering each other, and very favorable perceptions on the part of both that, again, were shadowed by this geopolitical suspicion and distrust on the part of both governments, and also the fact that governments tried to manipulate and control cultural relations for their own purposes, especially the Japanese government tried to do that pre-World War II. The war then explodes with such fury. It's not like you had, for example, in World War II in Europe in the beginning, what they called the phony war for about 8 months or so. It's not like that between Japan and the United States. It is vicious and furious and all-encompassing from the beginning, including, just a few months after Pearl Harbor, Jimmy Doolittle's raid on Tokyo itself. So, the war brought right to the heart of the empire and right to the heart of civilian Japan. The fighting between American and Japanese is of the utmost brutality, and it's been well chronicled in books and media, movies and television and the like. But it's just literally unimaginable the type of fighting that occurred and the brutality of the Japanese army, in particular the Bataan Death March and other things, so that these images do grow up in both countries where the Americans see Japan, the Japanese, literally as beasts, literally as monkeys and beasts that are subhuman, and the Japanese portray the Americans as hideous monsters out to defile Japanese women and rip apart their land. And of course, it all culminates in the atomic bombs dropped on civilian centers and the horrific destruction of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And we shouldn't forget Tokyo, which was firebombed in March of 1945 with loss of life greater than Nagasaki. So you don't have to have an atomic bomb to inflict that type of destruction. So given all of that, you would think that cultural exchange between the two countries is dead forever. Why could people possibly be interested in each other and each other's cultures after this horrific, 4 years of war? And the truth is that fairly quickly after the surrender, and particularly after the occupation is over in 1952, cultural exchange blossoms again. The shoots of a new era in cultural exchange push up from the ashes of war. And precisely, I think, precisely in part because of the existence of these old societies that had been going on for 20 or 30 years before the war, they're revived, and they still have people who are willing to try to commit to involving their countrymen in exchange with the other country. So you have a network that you can rely on. And then secondly, of course, Japan is the good peace for us. The occupation is a success. Japan is pacified. Question of war crimes is speedily dealt with, and the emperor is confirmed in his position. And suddenly we've got new worries. Just a couple years after that, China goes communist in 1949 while we're still occupying Japan. 1950, the Korean War. The world looks very different, and the Cold War has descended, so Japan suddenly seems to be a strong partner. And there's coincidence that both governments seek to exploit cultural relations and promote cultural relations as a way to maintain a strong political relationship through the alliance. So you have private entities on the one hand, you have public entities from the state, things like Fulbright or various Japanese groups that promote cultural exchange. But ultimately, you have the power of the market, and that is people accepting this and willing to vote with their dollars, so to speak. They are willing to get involved in these activities. The growth of Japanese studies in the post-war period is phenomenal. I mean, I'm a product of it. It's not unlike our interest in area studies in China or Europe or other areas, but it's somewhat striking that this country that we had defeated and had brutal fighting with and then had occupied now is considered one of our closer allies, and the people accept it. I mean, people in both countries see that there is something to be learned. The Americans get fascinated with Zen and get fascinated with the fact that Japan has modernized and rebuilt itself after the war. And the Japanese, of course, looked to the United States, you know, as the victors in this whole war, and the country that is the most powerful in the world, as a country to emulate. You know, what is middle class life there? What should we be striving towards? All of that is something that animates the next round of cultural exchange between the two countries, which starts in the 1950s.
Yeah, I think perhaps the popular conception, to the extent people think of the post-war era and the exchange between the two countries, is in this period from 1950 to 2000 is U.S. content, Japanese technology. Because I mean, the U.S. would come up with the software, but the Japanese were constantly outdoing us in kind of making the hardware, the Sony. You think of the Sony products and Japanese televisions and video recorders. And so, how did that kind of relationship work between America coming up with the soft content and Japanese coming up with the hardware work?
Well, it's partly this decision on the part of the Japanese to focus on consumer-oriented export industries as a way to rebuild the economy, not stimulate domestic demand at home, not invest in national defense because they rely on the Americans for that, but to only keep a relatively modest defense force during the 1950s and 60s and even into the 70s and beyond. And instead focus on things that can be exported. A huge boost for this is actually the Korean War, where Japanese companies get massive orders from American manufacturers for parts for different machinery. The Army is ordering from Japan. Of course, we're stationing most of our troops going to Korea in Japan, and they're rotating in and out of Japan. So it's a huge boon for the economy. And then you have some visionaries. You have visionaries from Honda, visionaries from Toyota, which had started before the war, visionaries like Akio Morita at Sony and others who are very well educated. They're internationalist in their outlook, and they recognize that this is a niche that Japan can jump on and a way to not only rebuild the country but normalize Japan in a way. I mean, you know, goods from Japan initially in the post-war years had been seen as cheap. You know, made in Japan had the connotation that maybe more recently we've had, you know, goods made in China, for example, that they're not of great quality. They're the lower end of the production scale. And Japan, by the late 50s and 60s, is moving out of that into the transistors, Sony's exports, certainly the cars, which I talk a little bit about, and their attempts to break into the American market in the 60s. And look, Japan's also blessed by great timing, just as they are getting, for example, in the automobile industry, as David Halberstam talks about in his book, The Reckoning. You know, just as they're really developing the export industry, starting to get a toehold in America with these smaller compact cars that went just the opposite from, how American cars were built and the size and the like, comes along the oil shock of the early 1970s. So there are moments of sheer luck for the Japanese, but also a lot of planning on the part of companies and the part of the state. There's less talk about, you know, the United States, for example, providing the soft ware of that, you know, if we can call it that, providing the knowledge and the Japanese taking advantage of it. That really doesn't come until we get significant trade deficits with Japan, starting in the 70s and particularly the 1980s, and then people start wondering about the free ride Japan is getting on the military, the fact that it seems to have a lot of trade barriers in its own economy and yet preferential access to the United States, and some arguing precisely that we had provided the intellectual know-how and the Japanese turned it into cash commodities.
Yeah, I think now there's a lot more sympathy for Japan and the U.S., both because of their recent economic woes and also because of the earthquake, tsunami, nuclear disaster. One other thing you talk about in the book, which I think is really interesting, since I know that you and I are both big baseball fans, you talk about Japanese baseball players. You said there have been 40 Japanese players on U.S. ball clubs, and talk about to what extent they are cultural emissaries. I know you kind of are dubious about that concept, but what do you think on that front? I know I read something that said that the Yankees were paying Hideki Matsui about $15 million in the last year of his contract with them, and he wasn't worth it in terms of production during the regular season, although he ended up being the World Series MVP and was great in the series. But he was worth it in terms of jersey sales in Japan, made enough money for the Yankees to justify that entire salary.
Yeah, I have no doubt. I mean, it's not as much as he was a cultural emissary as he was a commodity emissary for the Yankees, in the way that Fukudome is for the Cubs, Ichiro is for the Mariners, and you have a whole score multiple score of Japanese players now. I mean, what's interesting to me, again, as an historian, is that this goes back to the 19th century. The Japanese picked up baseball, which, as far as we know, and as far as I was able to discover in the book, is their sort of first foreign sport. They picked up baseball from some Japanese who had come over to the States in the 1870s and played on company teams. And a lot of folks might not remember that, you know, before you had the major leagues and the current professional setup of American baseball, you had companies sponsoring teams and leagues throughout the country and in their regions. And so railroad companies and the like would sponsor what in essence were semi-pro teams. And some Japanese had come over, and there's one I talk about in the book in particular, and comes over and brings this sport back. And very quickly, it's adopted both by Japanese companies and by Japanese schools. So today, the biggest sporting event in Japan, even bigger than sumo, is the annual high school basketball tournament. It's called Koshien. It happens every August, and it is phenomenal. The country just stops. Japan is made up of 47 prefectures. They're like our states. There is a intra-prefectural competition every year to send one team to represent the prefecture to Koshien, which is a stadium not too far from, it's in between Osaka and Kobe in the center of the country. So it's a huge national event. It's like the Final Four, but to be honest, bigger than the Final Four in the States. So it's enormous high school baseball in Japan. Of course, Little League, too. And, you know, the Japanese were Little League world champions a few years ago. Companies also in Japan still field semi-pro teams. They have really excellent teams and leagues, and those games are televised as well. So baseball has been part of, you know, Japan's cultural milieu and cultural landscape now for well over 100 years. And it was a way in which the two countries were brought closer together in the 20s and the 30s. And I talk about the barnstorming tours that Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig did in Japan, the way in which the Japanese press just went absolutely crazy over Babe Ruth and his All-Stars playing and basically followed them and their schedules down to the minute. And it got enormous play in all of the newspapers. Babe Ruth was beloved in Japan. And I tried to get a picture of him for the book. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to secure rights for it, but a picture of him in Japan. And that translated ultimately into professional league play in Japan, where you have a very expansive professional league system. And now Japanese players finally breaking into the States. So I think for us today, number one, we should recognize that really the depth of the Japanese love of baseball, and the fact, I should mention, that far more Americans have played on Japanese teams than Japanese have played on American teams. For years, there was basically an agreement that you could have two foreign, basically American players playing baseball on a Japanese team. You know, basically one guy in the outfield or infield, and then one pitcher. That's been broken now. Some teams have more. But some very well-known players, probably most famous is Cecil Fielder, who went over and played for the Hanshin Tigers in the 90s.
Bobby Valentine also.
And then Bobby Valentine managed in Japan and is loved by the Japanese, managed the champions, the Japan World Series, you know, the Japan Series champions, Warren Cromartie and others. And they're very, very well known. So I think for us now, we're actually more normalized to the idea of Japanese players. And so to have both pitchers and great hitters is something that isn't such a shock, but it is fairly new. And now you're seeing it with South Korean players and other players too. So the Japanese really were trendsetters in that.
Well, Misha, you've been very generous with your time. We have time for one more question, which is our New Books in Public Policy signature question, which is, what policies would you propose if you were czar for a day to enhance the U.S.-Japanese relationship?
Well, it's a good question. It's a great question. I mean, I think to keep with the spirit of what we've been talking about, to talk a little bit about what we should do culturally. I mean, because I think, you know, we have to be realistic that cultural relations don't, they won't prevent war. In many cases, they won't supplant political relations or economic relations. But for most of us, that's what's really important. I mean, and that's what my book talks about. It's the fact that Americans, for whatever reason, have been fascinated with Japanese culture, and they've devoted countless of thousands of hours of their time and lives to it, and vice versa for the Japanese. So it is an important part of the bilateral relationship. We may not think about it, when we're talking about the president meeting the prime minister, but it's really what most of us care about vis-a-vis the other country. And so I think that one thing that we do need to do, and within the spirit of cultural exchange, to try and improve understanding between peoples, which is always going to be imperfect, and to try to provide other outlets for connections between Americans and Japanese beyond what the state may provide or businesses may provide, is to recognize this interest and to help promote it and fund it and give opportunities for Americans to study over in Japan and Japanese to study here, to provide venues for exchanges of arts and culture and the like, things that we have done but that have dropped off somewhat in recent years. And I think what we'll find as the hopes for closer relations with China are probably belied by the limitations of what we can do together between Beijing and Washington. As India continues to be hesitant about the path that it wants to take in the world, and as other countries really focus inwardly, that our relations with Japan, I think, are going to become more and more important in terms of maintaining our position in the Indo-Pacific region. And I think that we should commit not only maintaining tight political and security ties with Japan, but we should also commit to maintaining this rather unique cultural relationship that has gone on for over 150 years and which has helped shape both of us into the modern nations that we are.
Well, I'm glad you think it's a great question, since it is indeed our signature question here on New Books in Public Policy. Misha Osland, thank you very much for joining us. The book is Pacific Cosmopolitans, A Cultural History of U.S.-Japan Relations. Misha Osland is a scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, and thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You have been listening to an interview on New Books in Public Policy with Misha Osland, the author of Pacific Cosmopolitans. In the book and in the interview, Dr. Osland talked about this notion of the enduring cultural exchange between the U.S. and Japan, and how important that cultural exchange has been in maintaining relations between the U.S. and Japan, even through periods of strife and after periods of war, and how important the relationship has been in terms of helping both the U.S. economy, U.S. and Japanese culture, and U.S. from a geopolitical perspective. Been a fascinating interview. I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope you join us next week on New Books in Public Policy. This is Tevi Troy. Thank you for listening.